Blog Talk Radio. Good evening. It is February 14th, 2017, 8 o'clock on the East Coast. This is the Ant Canary Experience. I am your host, Ant Canary. Welcome to the show. We've got a good show for you tonight. We're going to be talking about the story of Marcus Garvey. He is subject that is very rarely talked about in schools, so that's part of the reason why we're going to talk about them tonight. And we're still in the middle of celebrating Black History Month, and I'm going to play his entire biography special for you, talk about him, and see what else we're going to talk about tonight. If you want to call in, the number to call in is 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. And the chat room is open. So at the end of the show, I'll be taking your questions, comments, whatever. We'll probably go until about 10 o'clock because there's something that I need to do before I go to bed tonight. And that is last time when we spoke last week, I was expecting a grandbaby. As a matter of fact, we were expecting her yesterday, but she decided she wanted to show up a couple of days early, so she was born Saturday morning. So I have a new grandbaby. Name is Lauren, and I like to go spend a little bit of time with her before I go to bed tonight. So we're going to try to take off at about 10 o'clock. I'm still trying to get used to being a grandpappy. This is my first grandkid, so, you know, I'm just, you know, trying to be the best granddaddy I can be. And I joke, I say that I'm that I'm too young and too good-looking to be a grandfather. And then when I say that, people kind of look at me funny and say, well, at least I'm too young. But, you know, it's a wild feeling being a grandpa. So I am. And best believe that with my other children, got my daughter, got a baby daughter, and got my son. And I've been trying to make sure that they get the knowledge about our people because the schools don't teach this stuff. And best believe, new grandbaby will be getting the same. Same thing. So I'm going to be teaching them what they need to know, telling them the truth and all that good stuff. I'm excited about that. And this week, you know, I'm going to do the weekly, what I always do every week, talk a little bit about the president, not my president, but we're going to do our weekly Trump just in just a second. But I'm going to play our commercial. And then we're going to come back and do our thing. I'm going to give a little bit of information, a little bit of history on Marcus Garvey. And then I'll play the clips back to back. There's like five clips. Give you a better story about the life and the story of Marcus Garvey. He's one of the important people in Black history. So we're going to talk about him tonight. And then next week, I'm planning on having an attorney on next Tuesday night, and we're going to talk about the law and all that kind of stuff. So, just get you ready for that. I will be putting that up on the Facebook page. I'm sorry, let you know about that. So, hopefully, we'll have him on next week. You know, try to get some more good information. You know, that's what I'm here for. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play the ad, and then we'll be right back and get into the show. Be right back.
Welcome to Pamela Palace, where every customer gets the royal treatment. You may arrive feeling ordinary, but when you leave, you're guaranteed to feel extraordinary. We take pride and honor and serving you and treating you as the queens and kings that you are at Pamela Palace. So come and purchase beautiful scarves, shades, jewelry, etc. for queens, and for kings, we have wallets, bow ties, and much more. Need a royal experience? Well, contact me at Pamela Palace, PamalaPalace, on Facebook or Instagram, and also PamelaPalace@gmail.com. Thank you so much for your purchases, and please come again.
Okay, we're back. And what I always do before we get into the show, I play my weekly Trump diss because, as you know, I do not think this clown is a legitimate president, no matter what other people might seem to think. And if you've been keeping up in the news today, this weekend, he's been doing all kinds of stuff, trying to break people's hands off with a handshake, having dinners with dignitaries at his place in Florida with people all around taking all kinds of pictures and everything. And then today he had his first first resignation over some nonsense. And I've got a feeling that there's going to be more to come. But there just seem to be a whole lot of people that just seems to be think this guy is a genius or something. But I just got a feeling that we have only hit the tip of the iceberg as far as this guy goes. I think there's going to be a whole lot more going on that we haven't seen or haven't heard from yet. I got a feeling it's coming. It's coming. Just ain't got here yet, but I got a feeling some other stuff's going to come down. This week's clip, as you know, he tried to pass some kind of executive order against keeping Muslims out of the country. And like I told you before, whenever these this particular administration, whenever they say anything, you need to follow up and fact check. And I did just that, and come to find out what his argument is about. Basically, he wants to keep Muslims out of the country because he and people that follow him seem to believe that they're going to come over here and do terrorist attacks. We'll come to find out 80% of the terrorist attacks in this country are not from Muslims. Need I remind you of Oklahoma City 20-some years ago? The latest attacks were done by American citizens. They were not done by people coming in from our overseas. He made a list of countries that people were banned from coming from. Banned Syrian refugees and all that kind of stuff. But he didn't put Saudi Arabia on the list. And it's real simple why he didn't put Saudi Arabia on the list, because the 9/11 terrorists were from Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is one of our closest allies, and he has business ties in Saudi Arabia. So he knew that if he would have put them on the list, they would have been hell to pay. And he knew that, and we know that. So you can see through this mess already. But his thing was, he said that that wanted to keep Muslims out of the country, but it's okay to welcome in Syrian Christians. But then yet and still, he says it's not a religious ban. I mean, common sense would tell you that if you want to keep one religion out of the country, but you accept another religion because you accept that religion, then that's a religious ban. I mean, how much simpler can you get? I mean, that's just common sense. But you try to say it wasn't. We all know it is. you know, it's just crazy to sit and try to lie about it and say that it's something else when it's not, you know. So it was ruled unconstitutional. He is upset. His followers are upset, and they need to be upset. They can be upset all they want to, but you know, let's just be fair, and let's just, you know, stop. Let's just stop with the games. You know, he knew exactly what he's doing when he planned this stuff. All of this is religious discrimination. What's funny to me, and it's not really funny, but you have these Republicans running around in this country screaming Sharia law, you know, but they're just trying to do the same thing here. But it's not Sharia law. It's Christian law. What they fail to realize is that everybody in this country does not practice Christianity. And so what this guy and what his people are trying to do is they are trying to make this some kind of religious war, you know, us against them. And that's what these people have been doing for the longest. You know, what they're trying to do, they're trying to divide everybody, you know, black or white, rich and poor, Christian and non-Christian. Everybody in this country is not a Christian. Everybody in this country may, you know, have different religious views, but that does not make them any less of a person. It does not make them any less of an American. So this guy is, be honest with you, this guy is full of shit. And this clip is entitled, Second Court Agrees that Trump's travel ban is nonsense. And it pretty much is. And I'm going to play the clip. And then when I play the clip, we're going to get into the story of Marcus Garvey.
On late Thursday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals released their ruling on Donald Trump's Muslim travel ban, during which all three judges on that panel, a unanimous decision by that panel said, no, President Trump, your travel ban doesn't pass muster and we cannot uphold the legality of it. Immediately after this, Donald Trump tweeted out in all caps, see you in court, the nation's security is at stake. And here's the thing that Donald Trump has to understand at this point. Four different judges have looked at this. The case that was appealed to the Ninth Circuit had a one-judge panel, obviously. Ninth Circuit has three judges. All four of those said, no, this doesn't work. Two were appointed by Republicans. Two were appointed by Democrats. So we literally have a bipartisan group telling you that your bill is essentially gibberish. Because when you look at what the Ninth Circuit said, they weren't expressly focused on the executive order itself. They were talking about the fact that the executive order, the way it is written, does not make sense, not just legally, but grammatically, as a document, as an article. They can't make sense of it, were their words. We cannot make sense of it. They can't find any reason why people from those specific seven countries of the Muslim faith should be banned from the United States. The White House or Department of Justice did not present a good enough argument to validate this ban. And that's something that a lot of people have kind of glossed over with the Trump administration, is the fact that Donald Trump obviously does not know what he's doing. He has no legal background. He has no political background where he would even write laws. As far as the no legal background, he has no idea what is legal and what is not. And this is a problem that we're going to see with a lot of Donald Trump's executive orders. We're already starting to see that with his executive order greenlighting the Dakota Access Pipeline, which that challenge is going to be heading to court soon too. And it's because Donald Trump isn't smart enough. He doesn't have the training necessary to be the president of the United States. So yeah, he's gonna screw up because he doesn't know any better. And that's dangerous. That's why all this talk during the campaign about we need an outsider, somebody that hasn't been in Washington, that's bullshit. Look, I get that you don't want somebody who's been corrupted by corporations, but first of all, you elected the guy who is literally a corporation, probably the most corrupt one in the country, but he also has no idea what he's doing. And he surrounded himself with evil idiots who have no idea what they're doing. So yeah, Trump can appeal this, which would now go directly to the Supreme Court, likely in an emergency hearing type situation. And that, once again, is going to end very badly for Donald Trump, because what's on the court right now? An empty seat. We have four against four. And if the four liberals on that court say that this travel ban is unconstitutional or illegal in any way, then the decision would obviously then become deadlocked if none of the Republicans on the court vote with the Democrats. In the case of a deadlock, it's going to go back down to the decision of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that is that this executive order is gibberish, it makes no sense, it's illogical, and it should not be a law. And that will be the complete undoing of Donald Trump's travel ban, because he was so arrogant to think that somebody who doesn't understand what the law is could be put in a position of power in the United States to actually write those laws. So I hope he does appeal it. I hope it goes to the Supreme Court, and I hope they smack him down. Because at this point, Donald Trump could use a little bit of a reality check.
Okay. Well, we still got a long ways to go with this guy. I hope it doesn't go that long, but we're gonna see. If you wanna call in, the number to call in is 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. And the chat room is open. So call in if you can, get in the chat room if you can, or just listen online or listen to whatever you listen to the show on. Feel free to do so. And we're going to get into the topic of this week. And this is the story of Marcus Garvey. I'm going to give you a little bit of information on Marcus Garvey, and then I'm going to play his documentary about him. Give you a lot more information about him. I'll just give you the basics. He was born August 17th, 1887, and he died on June 10th, 1940. He was a Jamaican political leader, publisher, journalist, entrepreneur, and orator who was a proponent of the Pan-Africanism movement, to which end he founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League, which is the UNIA-ACL. He also founded the Black Star Line, a shipping and passenger line which promoted the return of the African diaspora, I think I said that, to their ancestral lands. And what that just basically saying is he was one of the few people that said that it was probably a good idea for all Africans to go, all black people to go back to Africa. And you can pretty much probably see why schools never talked about him. As a matter of fact, I had thought about doing a show on him a while back, but I never did get around to doing it. So I figured now would be a good time to talk about him, since we are celebrating Black History Month. And I'm still in the process of learning a little bit more about him. And I was doing research on him. I was reading and listening to clips and all that kind of stuff. So I thought tonight I would talk about him tonight. In 1914, Garvey returned to Jamaica, where he organized the Universal Negro Improvement Association, or the UNIA. In an article titled "The Negro's Greatest Enemy," published in Current History, September 1923, Garvey explained the origin of the organization's name. And he said, quote, "Where did the name of the organization come from? It was while speaking to a West Indian Negro who was a passenger with me from Southampton, who was returning home to the West Indies from, I think, Barstool land with his Barstool wife, I further learned of the horrors of native life in Africa. He related to me in conversation such horrible and pitiful tales that my heart bled within me. Retiring from the conversation to my cabin all day and the following night, I pondered over the subject matter of that conversation, and at midnight, lying flat on my back, the vision and thought came to me that I should name the organization the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities Imperial League. Such a name, I thought, would embrace the purpose of all black humanity. Thus, to the world, a name was born, a movement created, and a man came known. After corresponding with Booker T. Washington, head of the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama and a national African-American leader in the United States, Garvey traveled by ship to the U.S., arriving on 23 March 1916 aboard the SS Talek. He intended to make a lecture tour and raise funds to establish a school in Jamaica modeled after Washington's Institute. Garvey visited Tuskegee and afterwards visited with a number of black leaders. And the documentary gives a lot more information on what he did. And one thing he did, he started his own company, Black Star Line, which is an interesting story in itself. He was able to buy boats, ships, and all that kind of stuff. And he was married. He was married twice. Actually, his first marriage ended because he was just too busy trying to get his movement started. So he's a lot of interesting things about him. And one thing that you may not have known that I didn't know when I was doing the reading, there is a certain FBI director that plays into this also by the name of J. Edgar Hoover, which I did not know about. And it seemed like any time there was any kind of a prominent black leader, Hoover was involved in it some kind of way. And he even admitted it, that one of his main purposes was, he did not agree with black leaders, and he did pretty much everything he could think of to try to kill the black movement in this country. And I didn't know that when I was doing the research on this, that he played a part in this. So I'm going to play. It's got five parts to it. So I'm going to play the first part. Well, the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to play a clip. It's a little biography on Marcus Garvey, and then I'm going to go into the documentary on Marcus Garvey. So we're going to do that and be right back. And then hopefully the information I give out tonight on Marcus Garvey is something that, useful, just another chapter in black history. So sit back and listen, and hopefully you learn something.
Marcus Garvey wanted to return African Americans to Africa to create a vibrant black nation, empowered through economic independence. Although some of his goals were controversial, his crusade would inspire leaders from Malcolm X to Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela.
Garvey was certainly a controversial figure, but the concepts that we now think of as black nationalism and black pride started with Garvey's pronouncement.
Marcus Mosiah Garvey was born in St. Anne's Bay, Jamaica, on August 17, 1887. Beginning as a printer's apprentice at 14, Garvey became a union organizer and later worked various jobs across Central America.
Marcus Garvey found wherever he went, black people of African heritage in particular were always on the lower stratification end of society. This had a profound impact on him. Particularly, his concern was for the uplift of African people globally.
In 1912, Garvey sailed to London, England, and took night courses at Birkbeck College. After working for a Pan-African newspaper, Garvey returned to Jamaica in 1914 and formed the United Negro Improvement Association, or UNIA.
The UNIA was about black self-determination. It was about galvanizing the ideas of black repatriation to the motherland, the continent of Africa. And it was extremely important in terms of getting black people to understand self-pride, pride in one's race.
Inspired by Booker T. Washington to raise funds and start his own school, Garvey came to the United States in 1916. And in 1918 began publishing the Negro World newspaper.
Garvey was extremely outspoken. He was, some people would say, almost bombastic. He wanted to take over Africa and had elected himself as president of Africa without consulting the Africans, unfortunately.
Determined to achieve economic independence for African Americans, Garvey launched the Negroes Factories Association in 1919. And a shipping company called the Black Star Line, which he planned to use to transport passengers back to Africa.
Garvey was a great organizer, but unfortunately not a great businessman. During the time that Garvey and the UNIA were trying to launch the Black Star Line, they solicited funds from investors for stock options through the mail. And this resulted later on in allegations of mail fraud, and Garvey was convicted and sent to prison.
After serving 5 years in prison, Garvey was deported. He eventually moved to London, and in 1938, he supported the Greater Liberia Act, created by known white supremacist, Senator Theodore Bilbo from Mississippi.
Marcus Garvey's association with Senator Bilbo is related more on a practical level rather than an intellectual like for each other. Marcus Garvey's attempt to help Africans in America leave and go to Africa fell in line with some aspects of KKK philosophy.
Garvey died in London on June 10, 1940. He was reinterred in Jamaica in 1964 and is hailed as Jamaica's first national hero and the prophet of the Rastafarian religion.
Although Garvey was a flawed leader, he's someone who is really important to the history of the black radical tradition. He was probably one of the strongest voices of black nationalism in history.
In the United States, black troops returned from World War I with high expectations for change. But they returned to a country that was not ready for equality. A country increasingly suspicious of radical political movements. In this unsettled climate, Garvey's appeal to disgruntled African Americans with military training sounded an alarm.
Attorney General Palmer decided there needed to be a special division of the Justice Department. He called it the General Intelligence Division. And he picked a young Justice Department attorney. He was really unknown at that time, but must have been known enough for his diligence, and his name was J. Edgar Hoover. Garvey really gets pinpointed. Hoover, the Justice Department, were clearly hooked on a fixation on Garvey, which would before long become a vendetta.
J. Edgar Hoover wrote to a colleague, "Garvey is a notorious Negro agitator, affectionately referred to by his own race as the Negro Moses."
Hoover's agents were in the audience at Carnegie Hall when Garvey bragged that the UNIA would soon be strong enough to exact its own form of justice.
When those crackers lynch a Negro below the Mason-Dixon line, since it is not safe to lynch a white man in any part of America, we shall press the button and lynch him in Africa.
The agent reported that Garvey's address was met with great applause and much excitement. J. Edgar Hoover had long relied on casual informants, but now, in his determination to go after Garvey, Hoover hired the first full-time black agent in the Bureau's history.
He was known by a code number. All his reports were signed 800. That was his code. And his job was to go into Harlem and to infiltrate the Garvey movement to try and find evidence that could be used to build a legal case for ultimately getting rid of Garvey. Garvey rejected America. They could no more agree to and accept a militant rejection of America by blacks than they could accept a militant demand for full inclusion by blacks.
Just as the government campaign against him escalated, Marcus Garvey unveiled a new business enterprise. It was his most ambitious venture, but would prove to be the most fateful.
Get on board, countryman, get on board, ladies and gentlemen, get on board, countryman, wine home on the blocks all night, wine home on the blocks all night.
The idea comes to Garvey that black people need a shipping line, and he bases his idea on the fact that the Cunard family has the White Star Line and the Irish have the Green Star Line, and he says, why shouldn't blacks have the Black Star Line? So it is a vision of grandeur.
Black people were routinely Jim Crowed on ocean-going liners. Black folk paying, say, for first-class accommodation often had to travel in third-class accommodation. Black people on ships had to eat after the white people had finished eating. So all of these problems Garvey was trying to address through a shipping corporation.
His ships would carry more than passengers. Garvey envisioned commercial trade among black communities around the world, with produce, raw materials, and manufactured goods transported on UNIA vessels.
The Black Star Line was in some ways Garvey's Empire State Building. It was this monument to black commerce, in the same way that the Empire State Building was this citadel of white capitalism. And it represented the ability of black people to seize the day and to have their own economy.
Garvey offered Black Star Line stock for sale in 1919. Promising his investors liberation and large profits as they slept.
My parents spent a small fortune in Garvey shares. They were $5 a piece in those days, which was a lot of money. And my mother had to remind my father that there was food and things to be bought because he was buying shares. And Daddy had those on his dresser. And I remember reaching out to touch them. And Daddy said, touch them and feel the power that the black man will someday know.
Get on board, countryman. Get on board, leave this land. Get on.
Just months after his first stock offering, Garvey stunned the world with the purchase of the Black Star Line's first ship.
All aboard, bring the
day. Let our steamship sail the high seas. Not one, not two, but hundreds of them. The stronger we become upon land and sea, the more will be the respect shown to us, and the greater will be the glory.
The SS Yarmouth, a 33-year-old wartime coal boat that Garvey planned to rename the Frederick Douglass, would set sail with an all-black crew under the command of Joshua Coburn, a black captain. One bright November morning in 1919, Garveyites assembled on the pier at 135th Street in Harlem to witness the launching of the Yarmouth. A spectator said, "We watched people jump up and down, throw up their hats and handkerchiefs, and cheer while the Yarmouth backed from the wharf and slowly glided down the North River." The ship appeared to embark on a spectacular ocean voyage, but because Garvey had not finished paying for it, the Yarmouth went only as far as the 23rd Street Pier. But when the Yarmouth finally made its maiden voyage, it was cause for an international celebration. The president of Cuba threw a banquet in honor of the crew, and members of his cabinet purchased shares in the Black Star Line. In Costa Rica, workers descended on the docks to shower the Yarmouth with fruits and flowers.
It was announced that one of the ships of the Black Star Line would be coming to Panama and going through the canal. As a very small boy at the time, and my brother and I were given packed lunches, sandwiches, and drinks, and were packed off to a place called Christchurch by the Sea, waiting to see this Garvey ship arrive. We got there at about 9:10 in the morning, midday, no ship, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, no ship, but we were still there waiting. 9 o'clock, no ship. At about 9:30, 10, my brother put me on his back and we were on the way home. But the ship never actually came.
There's no denying the fact that Garvey's Black Star steamship line was a wonderful symbol. It was a powerful symbol. But it was nothing more than that, I think, a symbol. The fact that people would come down to the docks waiting for these ships in some ways is metaphoric for the wishful thinking that was largely at the heart of the Garvey movement.
Garvey was betrayed by the few people he trusted to get the Black Star Line afloat. The man he asked to inspect the Yarmouth turned out to be an informant for J. Edgar Hoover. And his hand-picked captain, Joshua Coburn, convinced Garvey to pay 6 times what the ship was worth, and then took a kickback from the purchase price. Yet Garvey quickly raised and spent $200,000 on 2 more ships.
And making a purchase of those liners without being led by experts, he was deceived about the condition of those ships and overpaid on what their value should have been. It was a disaster for the movement and turned out to be a disaster for Mr. Garvey.
At the end of 1919, Marcus Garvey married Amy Ashwood, the woman who just months earlier had thrown herself in the line of fire to save his life.
They had a very rocky relationship, a lot of off again, on again, a lot of quarreling. And finally they married in a spectacular Liberty Hall marriage on Christmas Day.
Their extravagant wedding was the talk of Harlem. 5 different ministers performed the ceremony before 3,000 guests. Just 4 months later, the couple separated. "Having a wife was an impediment to my work and peace of mind," Garvey would later say. "I can't pay her personal attention as the average husband. In fact, I have no time to look after myself."
My father was committed totally to the struggle. And that's why he never seemed to relax. He never seemed to take a day off. He was always committed to the struggle. He was always appeared to be dressed, ready to work. And he's working at home. He was working at the office. He kept tremendous hours. So it was a total commitment to the struggle and the cause.
The UNIA was taking in thousands of dollars a day, but Garvey lived modestly on the sixth floor of a Harlem apartment building. He didn't drink or smoke, and preferred to eat the same food night after night. Garvey spent his few idle hours arranging and rearranging a collection of Egyptian vases and African ornaments, making his home into an orderly private world. Unless it was about UNIA business, Garvey rarely spoke to even his closest associates.
I never saw him laugh. I never saw him laugh. At the office, he was serious when we went to visit him there and at home. Well, he was very kind. My father's very kind. He was always bringing things for us, the children. But I never saw him. He was always looked serious.
On August 1st, 1920, thousands of UNIA delegates from 25 countries assembled at Liberty Hall and Madison Square Garden. Garvey called it the International Convention of the Negro Peoples of the World. He hoped to move a step closer to his dream of a black nation in Africa, with himself at the helm.
The whole convention is this extraordinary public event of pomp and ceremony and magnificence and grandiloquence. Garvey, he would now establish a stage, a world stage for his movement. And effectively what he gave the black world was a government in exile, a government in waiting.
We have met in this historic building tonight for the purpose of enlightening the world respecting the attitude of the new Negro. If you believe that the Negro should have a place in the sun, if you believe that Africa should be one vast empire controlled by the Negro, then arise and sing the national anthem of the Universal Negro Improvement Association.
The month-long convention combined substance with overblown symbolism. Garvey installed officials with outlandish titles like Supreme Potentate, Leader of the American Negroes, and Lady Commander of the Supreme Order of the Nile. After insisting that no African was qualified for the post, Garvey named himself Provisional President of Africa. But behind closed doors, convention delegates produced a groundbreaking document.
They developed a program which was based on assessment of what was the black experience up to 1920, and how do we go forward, which led to the development of the Declaration of Rights of the Negro Peoples of the World. They were thinking there needed to be a black Declaration of Rights.
This was an important document that called upon the nations of Europe and America to respect the rights of black people throughout the world. This was the moment at which Garvey, I think, was both the most powerful in the sense of his articulation of ideas of justice along racial lines, and at the same time, his most grandiose and megalomaniacal, because there was really nothing behind any of this.
Garvey's reply to his critics was simple. "I am accused of creating dukes, barons, and knights," he said. "But who gave the white man a monopoly on creating social order?" Garvey's government in exile conducted its own foreign policy, appointing ambassadors and sending a telegram of support to the Irish Republican Army. He dispatched a team of engineers to Liberia to begin construction of a black homeland, and chartered a delegation to the League of Nations to argue for the transfer of African colonies to UNIA rule. When he finally took to the stage, it was Garvey's moment of greatest triumph.
25,000 people, black people, packed Madison Square Garden, and Garvey delivers this magnificent speech in which he tells the Europeans to give Africa a wide berth
because we are coming home.
The day after Garvey's speech, a massive UNIA parade stretched through Harlem.
If you didn't live in Harlem, you tried to find someone that lived in a front apartment where you could get in the window and view everything. Everybody seemed to be out there to see the Garvey parade.
To be a part of the Marcus Garvey movement, it made me feel that I owned one half of the world and I didn't own the other half because I didn't want it.
One Irish woman observing the parade remarked, "And to think, the Negro will get his liberty before the Irish."
And of course, we were looking for my father, who would be in the group of officers marching proudly down the avenue with his sword at his side. It was an exciting thing to see.
Marcus Garvey now stood at the head of the largest black movement in history. He claimed millions of followers around the world. But with the Black Star Line hemorrhaging money and his black critics and the U.S. government on the attack, Garvey's fast-rising star would soon begin to fall. Not all African Americans were thrilled by the splendor of the Garvey movement. Many were embarrassed by the pompous spectacle of Garvey in cap and gown. A. Philip Randolph, who had introduced him to his first Harlem audience, said Garvey had succeeded in making the Negro the laughingstock of the world.
W.B. Du Bois and A. Philip Randolph saw Garvey as a person who was engaged in a grand distraction. Garvey's emphasis on a program of African redemption, his pretensions to some kind of imperial posture as the provisional president of Africa, they thought of as either charlatanry or just pure buffoonery. Their complaints about him provide a legitimation for the government to move against Garvey. Because you can always say, you see, his own people don't even want him. And if they don't want him, then there must be something wrong.
Encouraged by growing black opposition, the U.S. government stepped up surveillance of Garvey. 8 federal agencies were directed to report on his activities, and J. Edgar Hoover resolved to deal with Garvey once and for all.
They placed spies in the UNIA. They sabotage Black Star Line. The engines sometimes of the ships were actually damaged by foreign matter being thrown into the fuel and so on. And there was every effort made to destroy the movement. However, that wasn't the only thing that actually destroyed Garvey. There were internal problems to the movement as well as these external forces.
Garvey's own crews took the Black Star Line to the brink of disaster. One captain steered his vessel off course to visit his wife. Another had a nervous breakdown and tried to sink his own ship. Enraged at the chaos on board one ship, Garvey got into a fistfight with the captain and fired half the crew. But when it came to mismanagement, he had only himself to blame.
Garvey looked for people who would be personally loyal to him. I think this is the only way we can explain the mismanagement and incompetence of the Black Star Steamship Line. The first treasurer of that line was a railroad clerk who had no experience in bookkeeping. What was important here, I think, was not an intellectual competence, but a loyalty to this charismatic leader.
As things spun out of control, Garvey confided in Herbert Boulin, the owner of the Berry and Ross Doll Company. To Garvey, Boulin was one of a few real friends. To J. Edgar Hoover, he was Agent P-138.
He got closer to Garvey than anyone else working for the government. And Garvey was really isolated. Things weren't going well with the organization. The Black Star Line was losing money. And so remarkably, he confesses to this informant that he'd tried suicide, that he was thinking of suicide again. It shows the loneliness Garvey must have had at the top. You know, he couldn't reveal those sorts of things to the key people around him.
By 1921, the Black Star Line was on the verge of bankruptcy. But Garvey mailed brochures to his supporters advertising stock in yet another ship. It would prove to be a major blunder.
In the brochure is a picture of a ship which purports to have been the SS Phyllis Wheatley. It was a ship that Garvey was negotiating for and did not own. And it seems that someone etched into the bow of the ship the words, the SS Phyllis Wheatley. In other words, it was a misrepresentation. It gave the impression that Garvey and the Black Star Line owned this ship, when in fact there was no such ship.
In January 1922, Garvey and three UNIA officers were arrested for federal mail fraud. The man Hoover once called a notorious Negro agitator was finally in his grasp.
The mail fraud was the most convenient and ultimately the only means that they could find to prosecute him. Prosecution was not the end. Deportation was the government's real aim.
In July 1922, while he was out on bail, Garvey made a move that would lead his black critics to question his sanity. He held a meeting with Edward Young Clark, the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
Garvey felt that the Ku Klux Klan represented the invisible government of the United States. That's the real source of power in America, Garvey believed. And Garvey felt that as provisional president of Africa, he was entitled to meet with the counterpart of white American power. And so Garvey didn't feel that he had done anything wrong. In fact, Garvey thought that what he had done was a diplomatic stroke of genius.
After he met with the Klan leaders and had them speak at his rallies, he was viewed as an enemy of black people. For a so-called responsible black spokesman to be having anything to do with these people was viewed as a complete and utter betrayal. This was too much.
In a letter to the Attorney General, eight prominent black critics said the UNIA was composed of the most primitive and ignorant element, Negro sharks and Negro fanatics. They called for Garvey's deportation, but Garvey fought back. When W.E.B. Du Bois called him the most dangerous enemy of the Negro race, Garvey said Du Bois was a rabid mulatto who needed a horsewhipping. A. Philip Randolph, who had once befriended Garvey, called the UNIA leader a half-wit, low-grade moron.
In the midst of that, A. Philip Randolph received a package in the mail, and thinking it was a bomb, he called the police. They opened it up, and they found that it was the severed human hand of a white man, signed with a note signed by the KKK. Randolph believed that it was really the Garvey movement that had sent it.
Garvey, now frequently accompanied by eight bodyguards, denied involvement and said he was the target of violence. But then Reverend James Eason, once Garvey's hand-picked second in command, and now expected to be a key prosecution witness, was shot and killed. Before he died, Eason identified his assailants as Garveyites. As Garvey's trial began on May 18, 1923, a police bomb squad stood on alert and UNIA members packed the courtroom. On the first day of the trial, Garvey fired his attorney and announced that he would defend himself.
I think Garvey believed that his powers of rhetoric and oratory would ultimately sway the court in his favor. He would have ruled the court, in other words, by his superior oratorical gifts. And I think Garvey came, in the end, to rue that decision because it was a disaster.
Garvey paced up and down before the jury box as a parade of former UNIA officials took the stand to testify against him. Defiant, Garvey blamed subordinates and evaded responsibility for his errors.
He also took a lot of time badgering witnesses, alienating, I think, in the process, a lot of jurors by his courtroom manner. He seemed to be intimidating of witnesses, even his own witnesses. It was not a good performance by Garvey.
In his closing statement, Garvey's voice carried clear through the corridors and out to the street.
I want no mercy, only justice, justice, justice. I would not betray my struggling race. If I did, I should be thrown into the nethermost parts of hell.
After a 4-week trial, his 3 co-defendants were acquitted, but Garvey was convicted and given the maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. Hoover's agents had the UNIA under surveillance for years in search of damaging evidence. But in the end, Garvey's conviction hung on using the mails to defraud one man, Benny Dancy, of $25.
He took no advice. He did not heed advice. He felt that anything contrary to his view of things was an attempt to derail him or to deflect him from his goals. He had just an overweening confidence in his own ability in areas where he had no expertise, such as in the case of ships, in the case of trying a legal case, in his investment priorities. He just would not take advice.
In February 1925, after nearly 2 years of appeals, Marcus Garvey was escorted to the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary as prisoner number 19359. His only personal assets were $40 and a few hundred shares of his own worthless stock. UNIA members believed their leader had been railroaded. To dampen their frustration, Garvey wrote a song.
Let no trouble worry you. Keep cool, keep cool. Don't get hot like some of you. Keep cool, keep cool.
Garvey's personal secretary, Amy Jakes, had become his second wife in 1922. While he was in prison, she and Garvey's followers struggled to keep the movement alive and raised tens of thousands of dollars for Garvey's defense.
There's one group in rural Louisiana that gave an average 5 cents. They actually gave $8, but when he actually counted the number of people involved, it actually amounted to something like 5 cents each. And it actually showed the level of loyalty that ordinary, the little people, had towards Garvey and the movement.
people around the world began to send in petitions and letters and so on. There were literally millions of signatures that were appended to petitions that were taken to various government agencies in Washington, D.C. In South Africa, people would have Marcus Garvey Sundays and pray for Garvey and so on.
If they put you in a flame, though you should not bear the blame.
But the government had its own reasons for wanting to release Garvey.
Keep cool.
Garvey had very weak lungs, and he also suffered from heart disease. He suffered from bronchitis, and a series of asthma attacks, was often put in the prison hospital. They feared that he could die or become severely ill, and it would just add to the martyrdom aspect of the Garvey movement and increase his following.
And there was an election year coming up in the U.S., and the Republican administration felt that black folk, who were largely Republicans in those days, might vote for the other party if Garvey was not released.
On November 18th, 1927, after serving 2 years and 9 months, Garvey was pardoned by President Calvin Coolidge. But he was ordered immediately deported. He was put on board the SS Saramaca, a ship owned by United Fruit, the same company on whose Costa Rican plantation he had worked as a young man. It was announced that Garvey would sail back to Jamaica from the port of New Orleans.
It was a Monday morning in November, a cold, drizzly, damp November, New Orleans morning. It was more like a Mardi Gras day in New Orleans on that particular day. I went out to see Marcus Garvey on this ship. I imagine the conductors got tired of asking for fares, so some people rode for nothing. And the fare was only 7 cents. And they were just packed on top of each other on the streetcar going out to the riverfront.
And everybody went out with their children, everybody just to get that glimpse of him as the ship would leave. And the people could stand on the levee and stand close to the river. And, you know, they were for miles and miles by the people.
Mr. Garvey was not allowed to land. He had to stay on board ship. He did not put his foot on land. And he spoke to the people, bidding them farewell and wishing them well and asking them to hold on, keep the fort. As the ship was moving out from the docks, the people on shore were singing the President General's hymn. One God, our firm endeavor, one aim most glorious bent, one destiny forever. God bless our president.
One we saw waving. We saw him do that with a handkerchief or something. But the people in general, they just was waving. Waving and crying and waving. Crying and waving.
And the waves appeared to have been in harmony with the song as the people were singing, and the boat was moving out to sea.
They felt they was losing their father. Somebody so close to them, or losing themselves. What are we going to do?
And my mother said until the day she died, she would not forget the sight of Garvey waving that white handkerchief as far as she could see the boat.
Back in Jamaica, Garvey received a hero's welcome. He and Amy Jakes Garvey settled in Kingston and had 2 sons. He tried his hand at elective office, real estate, an amusement park, a collection agency, and a newspaper. But when an American court took title to his personal assets and all UNIA property from New York to Kingston, Garvey was forced to declare bankruptcy.
Garvey was now a person who had come down in the world. And Garvey would be followed by children on the street, and they would heckle him. And Garvey felt very humiliated by this.
Garvey relocated to London in 1935. For a time, he had regular speaking engagements and managed to publish a newspaper. A handful of UNIA members, including Jacob Mills, migrated to Liberia on their own. But without Garvey's strong hand, his hundreds of thousands of followers in the United States dwindled to a small band of the faithful.
The men folk, if they had your names and everything, and you are a member of the UNIA, you'd lose your job. So you had to meet in disguise. That was one of the reasons why the Garvey movement was so thorough in being broke up. You couldn't say, I'm a UNIA member, I'm Marcus Garvey. You whispered it, Marcus Garvey. You could not speak his name.
Garvey was alone in London. The asthma and heart disease that had plagued him in prison began to worsen.
Garvey had a stroke in January of 1940, and he becomes incapacitated. George Padmore, who was a columnist for the Chicago Defender, had heard a rumor that Garvey had died, and instead of confirming this, he published a premature obituary.
The obituary described Garvey as a man whose followers had deserted him, a man who died broke, alone, and unpopular.
When Garvey reads it, he lets out a loud moan and he collapses. He suffers a second stroke. And next morning, he dies.
The date was June 10th, 1940. Marcus Garvey died a forgotten man. But his vision of Africa would influence future generations of what he called the beloved and scattered millions of the Negro race. When Garvey's passionate ideas about black pride and independence finally took hold, he would be revered by many as a prophet and a saint.
In death, I shall be a terror to the foes of Negro liberty. Look for me in the whirlwind or the song of the storm. Look for me all around you.
In his 53 years, Marcus Garvey never set foot in Africa.
I dreamed a dream that he came and I saw him. And he said to me, Barnes, do not be worried. For everything is working according to plan. I am not dead. I am only sleeping.
The organization left the legacy of I am. Simply, I am. With no apology. I am. We had never had that up to that time. We belonged to churches where we sang, but Garvey made you stand tall and quiet, looking into the future. And that's a great legacy.
Okay, well, that's the end of the clips and everything. Usually we go until about 10, but while the clip clips were playing, I just got word that my brand new grandbaby's not feeling too good, so I am going to have to cut this program short tonight. But I will be back next week with a new episode. I hope everybody learned something from this. And I do apologize for cutting it short, but my grandbaby's not feeling too well, so I'm going to go take care of her. So I will be back next week. And also realize that today is Valentine's Day, so I know a lot of you are probably out doing your thing. So have a happy Valentine's. Like I said, I hope you got something from tonight's episode, and I will see you next week. Peace out. See you.